welcome to Arbitral Insights, a podcast series brought to you by our international arbitration practice lawyers here at Reed Smith. I'm Peter Rocha, Global Head of Reed Smith's International Arbitration Practice. I hope you enjoy the industry commentary, insights and anecdotes we share with you in the course of this series, wherever in the world you are. If you have any questions about any of the topics discussed, please do contact our speakers. And with that, let's get started.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to our Arbitral Insights podcast series. And I'm delighted today to have as our guest on this episode, Hasit Seth. Hi, Hasit.
Hi, Gautam.
It's really nice to have you on. I'm really excited about our conversation. Hasit is an Indian lawyer based in the wonderful city of Mumbai. He's also, apart from being an independent counsel, he's an arbitrator and mediator, and he's a fellow of the Chartered Institute of Arbitrators. He has a very interesting academic background, which in many ways instructs his practice, because he, apart from having a commercial practice, also has a technical specialism in a number of areas in the law. He has a Bachelor of Science in Computer Science and two master's degrees, as well as an LLB. He has studied in the US as well as in India. And apart from being an incredibly talented counsel, he's one of this new generation that I really love, these new arbitrators who are coming in, breaking the mold and gaining real profile. And I mentioned in my introduction that apart from his commercial practice, Hasit has a technology side to his practice, which emanates from the fact that one of his master's degrees was in intellectual property. So he has a broad range of talents, and I'm very excited to speak to you, Hasit. And apart from being an arbitrator in India, I will just say that Hasit is also empaneled as an arbitrator in many other arbitral institutions regionally and in the Middle East. And I've got no doubt that his name is one to watch in the world of sitting arbitrators. So once again, a very warm welcome to you, Hasit.
Thank you very much, Gautam. And I really appreciate Reed Smith's this series of podcast Arbitral Insights, because I got to know of many people through your podcast who I would not have come across. People from West Indies, people doing mediation, and many other names. So it's really exciting.
That's very, very kind of you to say. And it's a real privilege to have you on this series. Let me start with what drew you to law as a career in the first place, Hasit?
Yes, so I have seen you, heard you asking this question on many podcasts, Ivan. So let me start with a wrong answer. So my wrong answer is that my dad was a lawyer and a judge, and that made me do law. But that's a wrong answer, because he himself was a nuclear scientist and then turned to law, Ivan. So it wasn't traditional for him, and it's also not traditional for me, because I was destined to be a programmer. I enjoyed computer science and I was a professional programmer. What I heard from him is that law is a very interesting subject to study as a mental discipline. So I did law for that, and he was very open that you don't need to practice law. You can do other things in life after a law degree. But what fascinated me and brought me to law as a choice is that in computer science, we have very definite, determinate answers in any branch of science. It's very perfect in that sense. While in social sciences, of which law forms a branch, there are so many right answers and so many wrong answers, and different interpretations of the same thing. I think after, around 400 years of common law, we should figure out what is an offer and an acceptance. But yet, it gets reinterpreted after some years all the time. So that's what fascinated me and brought me to law.
Well, and that's incredible. I mean, it's not often I hear of a nuclear scientist turned lawyer turned judge. And I can see that the genes on both the science and the law certainly flowed over to you, Hasit.
Thank you.
In terms of your career to date, who have been your greatest and biggest career mentors and inspiration?
So I'll start with a little broader slate. I've always admired a maverick scientist, Richard P. Feynman, a Nobel Prize winner and a physicist who worked on the bomb, and many other things. So his life has always inspired me in a big way. In computer science, there is a Stanford professor retired, Donald Knuth, and Donald Knuth has written a legendary set of books. These are artists in their own way. Then my immediate inspiration in law and somebody who taught me a lot of things was Mr. Greg Stobbs. He was a partner at Harness IP, where I worked in Detroit for 3 years. And he taught me like patent prosecution and patent litigation. So these have been my inspirations. But one of the early inspirations was an old book that I bought called Six Great Advocates. So these were all English advocates, Edward Marshall Hall and others, So they were small biographies of six great advocates. And I was just fascinated by all that. So I think trial lawyers everywhere, are an inspiration. And my dad was a big trial lawyer. These have been inspirations. But I find the adversarial process fundamentally fascinating. And that's what inspires me all the time.
Thank you. And, it is very interesting, when you say that we draw mentors and inspirations from a broad range of fields and experiences. And, what you've said really resonates with me. And indeed, many of the other guests on this series have said exactly the same thing. So it's really interesting when we draw these common threads together. Thank you for sharing your thoughts there. Well, one of the things I mentioned, Hasid, in the introduction is that you have a very broad arbitration practice amongst other areas, but arbitration is one of your core fields. And I'm also very proud of your increasing profile as an arbitrator, and the fact that you're getting the due recognition with a number of institutions that you deserve, because I love to see new people, new arbitrators breaking through the system. But let's just row it back, and we'll come back to what I just spoke about in a little bit. But let's start at the beginning. How did arbitration find you, or how did you find arbitration? How did you first get to do arbitration? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. So the first arbitration I attended was while I was in the final year of college. My father was doing a trademark plus partnership dispute, a long-running partnership dispute. So that's the first one I attended, But I was just like observing as a bystander. I went to US and had a US career in patent law. But when I returned to India, I was working in-house and all that. But when I returned to Mumbai, I found that patent litigation is a very small niche area, in India. I wanted a broader canvas, and disputes was always something that I've done and loved. So went into a firm and then independent. So we have a model similar to the UK barristers. We call them councils in Bombay. It's an informal kind of a system because that's what we follow. But that's where I turned to arbitration, and fortunately have works come in as a counsel and increasingly as an arbitrator. And there are bigger forces. India is building so much of infrastructure and there is construction everywhere. So it was like round peg in a round hole. Somebody with a tech background, with a disputes, this thing, experience and this thing. And so it just I am there at the right time when so much is happening around arbitration in India.
Yeah, and arbitration is really happening. India and arbitration are now synonymous in so many ways. It's fair to say, isn't it, Hasid, that there are challenges in India with arbitration law, and it's an area still in development, which is no bad thing because everything needs to develop. But I wonder if you could just share some of your thoughts about what are the challenges for arbitration law in India, and what sort of reforms do you think might be valuable to assist as part of bringing arbitration in India into a much, better place?
Sure. So I've been thinking about this, observing like global jurisdictions where arbitration is a big success, that legal culture in a place within which arbitration operates. So arbitration is never divorced from the courts completely. I mean, challenges to the awards under the ancestral model, etc., have always been there. So the courts have a role. I mean, now, what kind of role the courts want to play, that's actually, you know, very jurisdiction specific. So if English courts don't set aside the awards, I mean, easily, that's a choice which that jurisdiction has made. India, I mean, one of the challenges is that we have a certain litigation culture here also. And arbitration is like a new flower that has grown up in that garden. How much of that litigation culture comes into arbitration and how much of it influences the court system? That's an ongoing process. It's almost a dialogue between arbitration and the legal courts and part of the whole legal culture. What I see as challenges, and you're absolutely right when you say that they are challenges, because it's growing and growth always comes with challenges. So one thing I would suggest is, or think is, you know, there is need to move to, from ad hoc arbitrations to institutionals, and we can start with appointments. A government had made amendments, but they have not notified them. And we have fine institutions like, say, Mumbai Center for International Arbitrations and others who can easily do. In Delhi, there is a DISC who can easily do the appointments. I mean, why do the courts need to do them? So that's a low-hanging fruit which can be easily brought in. And then we can reduce the role of courts for both interim relief and essentially anything that happens during the arbitration. Because people, litigants think that, you know, you get an order in an arbitration, then again you have to go to courts to enforce it if the other side doesn't follow. So why don't we go to courts directly? I mean, so the courts should discourage any, that's written into the law also, that they need to discourage anything in the interim while the arbitration is progressing, so that, you know, the focus is only on the completing the arbitration process, I mean. And other thing is, I think there have been some efforts, but we fundamentally need to rethink how awards are executed or enforced. So that there needs to be some work, because that's all in the domain of civil courts. I mean, the enforcement of the awards. So there needs to be some fundamental re-engineering of it. And I understand the older rules are meant when land was the only biggest asset. The real estate was the biggest asset against which you could enforce the awards. But today, money is in bank accounts, is in stock markets, all that. So all that can be target for enforcement quite easily instead of a long-drawn process.
Thank you. And you know, and I think these are the things, because, I mean, you know, we often hear, don't we, Hasin, that India has ambitions to become an arbitration hub. And I love that, because I truly believe that India will become an arbitration hub. And why shouldn't it? Because it's one of the biggest economies in the world. It's now the fifth biggest economy in the world. It's got the world's biggest English-speaking population. It's got an absolutely world-class legal profession, a great legal heritage. And there are huge companies operating in India and from outside India operating in India. So why shouldn't it become a hub? So I wonder, though, can I ask you this question? And this may be a mischievous question, Hasin, but you know I'm a mischievous man. If you were to look at your crystal ball and just think about the future, do you have a feeling as to how long it might take for India to get in a position where, with reforms, with all sorts of experiences along the way, it can become that arbitration hub?
Yes, I'll take the risk of saying that my crystal ball says it will be within 5 to 10 years period. I mean, I don't see any longer time required, because all the forces are aligned. You come to, you know, India often, I mean, to arbitration conferences, other things. You can understand what the judiciary thinks when the judges come and speak at the conferences. And also the government's, you know, willingness to support the economic reform. The direction of India's growth is now primarily economic, I mean. So the rest of the software, hardware now is in place. So I think it's just a matter of time of taking less than 10 right steps, less than 10 right steps, and it will be a hub. You look, one of the biggest aviation markets, people say flying in and flying out would hardly be a problem. It has got great tourist centers like Goa or, you know, Bombay, or I mean, any place where the rest of the infrastructure of like hotels and, you know, hearing centers, etc. We have got one of the best, you know, like mobile telephony. I mean, you come to India and the mobile speeds are excellent and a very reliable mobile infrastructure, and it consumes data like nobody else. I mean, so what's left? I mean, I just think we need 10 steps, 5 to 10 year period of stability, and 5 to 10 right steps in sequence, and we are there, hardly a problem.
You know, I love that, because, you know, I'm looking forward one day to see India become that hub, because I'm genuinely excited about that. I don't see why it shouldn't become a hub. I think for all the reasons that I've mentioned, but more importantly, those that you've mentioned, India really should be that hub. You know, as you'll know, there's been so much progression over the years. And so, you know, I just think it's just a wonderful thing to see. And, you know, I actually share your prediction about the timeline it'll take. So I'm glad that you and I, and, you know, you and I didn't share our thoughts on that at all. So, and one thing I think, just so that our listeners know, these podcasts are not orchestrated. They're not scripted. They're all completely impromptu. So everything we're saying here is completely off the bat, as they say.
True.
Well, look, Hasid, thank you for that. Now, before I turn to ask you about your role as an arbitrator, because I'd like our listeners to hear some of your thoughts about your role as arbitrator, I wonder whether you could share with our listeners if you see any trends in arbitration in India, some significant trends that you think are going to be happening in the next, in the short term.
Yes, so one thing is the efficiency in arbitrations is going up. Interestingly, India is one jurisdiction that experimented with a fixed time for arbitrations, that you must finish it in this time, otherwise there are consequences. And that has worked really well, I mean. So that's one very good thing. We have a very good set of young arbitrators who are coming up, I mean. So, and also it is exhibiting the you know, the general trend in India where women outnumber men in legal profession. The women are entering, you know, legal profession in much larger numbers than before, obviously. But I think the ratio is now slightly tilted, more women than less men. And that's also being reflected in arbitration. I mean, both the party councils, the arbitrators, and also like women business leaders who are taking active role in all management positions also. So everybody, all stakeholders in arbitration, you'll see these changes.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's wonderful to see, because there is happily much more diversity in the world of arbitration now. Women are rightly getting the profile they deserve. And the Absolutely. Recognition they deserve. I also noticed, just as we're doing this podcast, just a couple of days ago, the new round of senior advocates were announced in India.
Yes,
and there's
yes.
a large batch of female senior advocates who've been announced.
Senior
I think
advocates.
It's 11.
11. True.
New senior advocates who are women. Now, many years ago, that was unheard of. That would
unheard of. Very true.
No one would even be thinking that, and it's just so wonderful.
Yes.
That we're now seeing this, and we're seeing more and more female managing partners of law firms, more and more female arbitrators coming up in India, which is great. So, no, look, that's a trend, Hasid, that I'm very, very happy to see, as indeed you are. So let us turn now to your role as an arbitrator, because as I mentioned in my opening, one of the things that really has been wonderful to see is, for me, that I've been so proud to see, and I will continue to be very proud to see with you, Hasid, is your continued rise as an arbitrator, because I love to see new people coming through. And And although I love judges, ex-judges being arbitrators, I think there's definitely a role for more and more non-judges. But just tell us a little bit about some of the lessons you've learned from your role as arbitrator, because I know that you've sat as a sole arbitrator, as a member of a tribunal, and as a presiding arbitrator. Yes. So tell us some of your thoughts as to what you've learned along the way so far.
Yes, so one of the first, from the very first arbitration I sat as an arbitrator, I realized that you need, as an arbitrator, support of the party councils, councils representing the parties, and parties also to conduct the process of arbitration very smoothly. So you need for them to buy in and believe in the process that is happening. You don't want them as your adversaries. You want them as your allies. I mean, as such, on the procedural part, the substantial part, merit, I mean, depends on the facts, I mean. But essentially, for the procedural smoothness, you need their cooperation from very early on. From the PO1, when you are setting up, you know, the whole, the timetable for the arbitration and how it will go about, that's a big lesson that I quickly learned, I mean, that you need their cooperation. The other thing I have observed is that although it's an adversarial process, you need a series of small agreements on the procedural side with all the stakeholders. For that, when the hearing should be held, how evidence should be taken, you know, there is always a challenge if one side wants the evidence to be of the traditional style where all the documents are proved and all that, or you would want, you know, like it to be the Redfern style, objections, all that. So extent of cross-examination, role of the experts, all that needs a series of small agreements at every stage. So a very congenial kind of atmosphere, non-pressured atmosphere, where procedural things are taken care of in a very fair and efficient manner. I think the arbitrator has a big role in it, and he has to be somebody who builds that consensus. So those are the early lessons I got. The other thing, sir, and I think most arbitrators would be feeling it at this time, even the party which loses appreciates the efficiency of the arbitration. Ultimately, when the party which is on the losing side, they say we have saved time and money because the arbitration went on very efficiently and smoothly. So they also appreciate. So, I mean, this is something I really like that and consider it as a badge, you know, like you would get at the end that you did a good job.
I completely agree with you. I think that whole issue about efficiency and the process is something that I think can never be underestimated. One of the things that I must say has said that I've always thought over the years that I've been in practice is that the arbitrators for me who've always stood out are the ones, as you say, who build a rapport with the parties. Because that's really important, not thinking that they're aloof from the parties, but that they're there for the parties. Because one of the things that I think some arbitrators over the years have unfortunately got wrong is they've lost the sense that they are there to serve the parties, not vice versa.
Correct.
Arbitration
true.
Is a consumer business. The arbitrators are there to serve the parties. And I think, so what you say, I completely resonates with me totally. And I think the other thing that's hit me over the years when I look back at my experience over the years is that point, again, it's tied to efficiency. But the fact that the parties feel that the arbitrators have done a really good job, that they haven't cut corners, that they've been fair. They haven't just taken a compromise position on things, that they've actually decided things on the merits each time. And that can range from a document request issue, that could range from other procedural issues to other procedural issues. It could even range to how a witness feels they've been treated in the witness box. It's just a question of that overall feeling of fairness and that the arbitrators have been engaged in the process. Because one of the things I'm sure you'll have found, and of course I won't say anything about names, you won't say anything about names, but there are some arbitrators who are very invisible in hearings, who don't make their presence felt enough, and some who are overly visible and overly audible. And I think there's a balance to be struck. I mean, I'm sure, and I would like to think you'd agree with that. But no, I think, you know, but I mean, I'm very interested, as I say, in your thoughts. So thank you for sharing your thoughts as an arbitrator. So let me, you know, we, as I'm sure you know, Hasid, we like to end our podcasts with a little bit of more lighthearted discussion. Everyone knows now about your incredible academic background, your journey to become what you are now, the fact that you've studied and worked in the US, that you've got an incredibly varied practice. You're an arbitrator, you're a mediator, you're an independent counsel. I should have said that you're with H Chambers in Mumbai. And you also write extensively for many journals. You give many lectures. So you've got a lot of things you do in the law. But let's now stop talking about law. Let's stop talking about arbitration. Let's talk about you, the person. When you have some spare time, what do you enjoy doing?
Yes. So I mean, long ago, you know, had this thing that I'm too much drowned into words. I wanted something non-verbal as an interest. And what caught my fancy was drawings. Drawings as a discipline, I mean. And starting from, you know, like caveman drawings, I mean, Neolithic stuff, to like very modern practice. But I started collecting a lot of prints of many drawings. But, and I have a very large collection of drawing-related books, I mean, which I've collected in the US and I still collect. But what I find, you know, like the most fascinating are the drawings of the Renaissance era, I mean, and of old masters like Rembrandt and others. I mean, that's just a superlative human achievement. I mean, there is now research showing that some of them used camera obscura and those kind of tools to aid. But despite that, I mean, you know, you look at a Leonardo da Vinci drawing or a Michelangelo drawing. I mean, Queen has a number of them in her collection. And they're like extraordinary human achievement. How can you draw like that? I mean, so I just find those things very interesting. I have a large collection. I keep like reviewing that all the time.
Oh, well, yeah, amazing. You know, I mean, art is a great thing. And so varied as well in terms of everything. So, is there a particular place outside India that you enjoy traveling to? Is there a favorite travel spot?
Yeah, US, I mean, any day. I mean, obviously, because I used to live there. But the city, which is New York City, I really like it with its museums, particularly the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I mean, New York's a great place, I mean. So, and also, I like U.S. national parks. I mean, they are amazing. I mean, the scale of U.S., I don't think so anybody living outside U.S. can imagine. It's a continent. It's not really a country. And I got a chance in 5 years to explore it, but I still love going back. I mean, any opportunity I get. And within India, I really like Rajasthan. Rajasthan is amazing. With Udaipur, I mean, in particular, it's a very lovely place. I mean, in desert, people have created such wonderful places.
Yeah, I agree. I think Rajasthan is an incredible place. And I've been very fortunate over the years, Hasid, to have been to a number of places in Rajasthan. I've been to Udaipur, to Jaipur, just to name two places. And those in themselves, I mean, are incredible places. I've also had the very good fortune to stay on the Lake Palace in Udaipur.
Oh, and, lovely.
And that's, you know, that is, so for those of our listeners who don't know, that was, it's a very famous a Taj Hotel in the middle of a lake, but it's also where the James Bond film,
James Bond movie was shot,
had some scenes shot, and you know, and Octopussy was a Roger Moore film. I still remember those days.
I mean, I'm a James Bond fan, and I watched all the movies in series. I find that to be the weakest movie ever made. There is a circus at the end and all that. I think Roger Moore must have regretted doing it later on.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure he didn't regret staying at the Lake Palace, but I'm sure
I'm being launched from a cannon and all that. I mean, they were like, just too much.
I know, very strange. Some of those films were very strange. But that's, I suppose, what makes them so enjoyable, because people don't forget those scenes.
They're quirky, I mean. So
we're
that's
talking about it on this podcast.
Because I have read all the Ian Fleming books also, and I was wondering, you know, what would he feel about, you know, like watching Octopussy?
I know, it's amazing. I mean, we can only speculate, but one thing that I don't need to speculate on is that this has been a fantastic podcast. I really enjoyed doing it with you, Hasib. Thank you very much for being such a wonderful guest, being so engaging, so open with your thoughts, and for giving us real insight into how you think about many, many things. And so thank you very much for that, Hasib. And I look forward to seeing you in person very soon.
Thank you very much, Gautam and Reed Smith, for having me on the show.
Arbitral Insights is a Reed Smith production. Our producer is Ali McArdle.
For more information about Reed Smith's global international arbitration practice, email arbitralinsights@reedsmith.com. To learn about the Reed Smith Arbitration Pricing Calculator, a first-of-its-kind mobile app that forecasts the cost of arbitration around the world, search Arbitration Pricing Calculator on reedsmith.com or download for free through the Apple and Google Play app stores.
You can find our podcast on Spotify, Apple, Google Play, Stitcher, reedsmith.com, and our social media accounts at reedsmithllp on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. This podcast is provided for educational purposes. It does not constitute legal advice and is not intended to establish an attorney-client relationship, nor is it intended to suggest or establish standards of care applicable to particular lawyers in any given situation. Prior results do not guarantee a similar outcome. Any views, opinions, or comments made by any external guest speaker are not to be attributed to Reed Smith LLP or its individual lawyers. All rights reserved.